Right, let's get started with the situation right now in the Kursk region. And they're asking civilians to leave the region. We remember the last time we heard Russia asking civilians to leave was in Syria against ISIS. There was nothing left but sand after Russia put the hammer down in those days. Right now, how do you see the response coming from Russia in order to respond to NATO and Ukrainians in this region?
Well, Nima, this is a very curious turn of events. And I think the net effect will be to elicit a very strong Russian response. As circumspect as Putin has been, he faces a lot of pressure now that Russia itself has not only been raided, but invaded, okay? That's the difference. So when I hear reports that 200,000 civilians have been taken out of those areas, that's exactly what I think you mean, Nima. Obliteration of those areas is bound to follow. The whole notion that Zelensky would do this defies explanation. Now, some people are saying, well, maybe he wanted to seize some territory to trade with the Russians. Well, you know, it's crazy. If he thinks that he can hold on to parts of Kursk Oblast, he's crazy, okay? Now, Obama said that very early, 2015. He said, look, the worst thing we can do is to give the Iranians the notion that they can prevail militarily against a much stronger Russia. So let's not give them offensive weapons. That made a lot of sense, okay? I don't know what has become of Biden and Blinken and Sullivan, where they think they can.
Wait, you mean Ukrainians?
The Ukrainians, yeah. What did I say?
You said Iranians.
I'm sorry. No problem. I got them both on my mind.
Go ahead.
The Ukrainians, of course, yeah. So what we have here is disregarding the good sense that Obama had and challenging Russia in this very sensitive area. Now, how did it come to be that these troops were able to invade Russia? I don't know. It really doesn't matter a whole lot. And now, in retrospect, my best guess is that the Russians thought this would be a crazy thing to do. I mean, hello, it's a crazy thing to do, okay? No real strategic benefit unless the Ukrainians were stupid enough to think they could make it all the way to the Kursk nuclear power plant. And that was, you know, if they thought they could do that, you know, that's just the latest of the illusions they have. So whether or not, you know, my imagination says that, yeah, of course, there was evidence that there were troop concentrations in that area on the Ukrainian side. But Gerasimov is looking at this and he's looking at the Donbas where the real battles are going on. And he says, well, my God, if they're crazy enough to go in there, we'll get them out right quick and they'll suffer a bloody defeat, the more so since they're the crackerjack Ukrainian outfits, the brigades that are well-trained by NATO, well-equipped by NATO. So that's the eventual outcome of this thing. The latest word is the Ukrainians are still there. If you believe them, they're still expanding their presence there. But the Russians are constructing fortifications that won't quit, the kind of fortifications that they had before the 2023 celebrated spring, well, not spring, summer counteroffensive by Ukraine. So what's going to happen? It seems to me that another week, maybe 10 days, what's left of the Ukrainian crackerjack battalions and brigades will be decimated, perhaps most of them killed. The Ukrainians don't have a whole lot in reserve. As a matter of fact, most people say these people are the only reserve they have left. And Putin is likely to be under increased pressure to say, well, you know, this is it. We gotta do something really, really more aggressive. And there are all kinds of options he could do that along that 1,000-kilometer line where they're face-to-face Ukrainian troops with Russian troops. Or he could threaten Kharkov. He could even threaten Kyiv. And, you know, it's quite possible to remove Zelensky one way or another. And there are certain candidates coming up that might be better, although no likely names have surfaced yet, as far as I can see, to take Zelensky's place. The election year in the United States is the crucible here. I think that Putin probably still needs to be believed when he says nothing's going to happen before the election. That may change now with this invasion of Kursk. Now, bear in mind, your viewers probably remember this, at least if they're as old as I am or slightly younger. One of the main battles in World War II, 1943, tank battle in Kursk. I think the Russians lost about 800,000 people in that one battle. They had Stalingrad, Kursk. People remember Kursk. I mean, every schoolboy, you don't have to be very old, they learn about Kursk, okay, and how the Nazis put up their last fight and sacrificed lots of Russians, but the Russians prevailed, okay? That was before the Allies came in 44 in June with the invasion of Normandy. So there's historic significance to this, historic trappings. And how long Putin will retain his sang-froid and say, okay, I'm not going to be provoked by anything. We'll drive these guys out. We'll decimate their forces. We'll continue on moving toward the west there, toward Kyiv and for the rest of Ukraine up to the Dnieper River. But we're not going to do anything that the West could use as a pretext to up the ante even further. That would be my guess, having watched Putin all these years. Now, it could be that if there's truth to the fact that this was an unwelcome surprise to Gerasimov, chief of staff of the Russian forces, that he may get the can. There are lots of reasons to think that he really hasn't been up to snuff. And if that's the reason, that Putin will can him. That's what happens, okay? But the Russian forces are in a position to move, and they will keep moving. How fast is anybody's guess? If they really wanted to embarrass Biden and the Vice President Harris, then they might do something really, really definitive win in Ukraine before the election. But I don't think the Russians particularly want Trump to come in. The thing that they favor above all, I believe, and actually Putin said this not too long ago, is consistency, is predictability, was the word in Russian that he used. And, you know, Trump is not very predictable. Harris, maybe a tad more predictable. So I think we can rely on what Putin said about a month ago, saying, look, nothing's going to happen before the election takes place in November. Then we'll take stock and see where we are, see if there's any sense left in the United States, and see if they will be able to come to terms with the fact that they've lost and that they have to sort of do the best deal they can.
Right. One of the things that we know from Russia is how the Putin administration, specifically Putin, is so pruned and he's so cautious about everything. With the NATO expansion, they reached to a point that they had no option but going into Ukraine and fighting NATO. And right now it seems with these escalations on the part of the United States and NATO, sending more weapons, cluster bombs, tanks, F-16s, and right now attacking on Russian soil, it's something different from what we've seen so far in the conflict. don't you think that this patience is getting away from Russians, that they're just not having any sort of patience for this type of activities that coming from NATO? Because every time that they're thinking that they can be more cautious, it seems it's going to be perceived by NATO and the Biden administration, as they're afraid of NATO. It's unbelievable what's going on.
Well, you're quite right, Nima, but look at it from this point of view. My career was spent trying to put myself in the shoes of whoever was leading the Kremlin at the time. The way they're looking at it is, look, we've all but won in Ukraine. Okay, the U.S. is scattered around the world, facing the possibility of a two-front war, including the Middle East. Three-front war if the Chinese rise to the occasion and start to threaten the U.S. and the South China Sea or the Taiwan Straits. So we're in a position of power, that disequilibrium of power with respect to China. It's two against one now. Now, the only danger is that the people running U.S. foreign policy, Blinken and Sullivan, don't seem to get that. I mean, from the outset, they told Biden, now, look, he can play Russia off against China. Well, that's what Kissinger did, but that was 40 years ago, for God's sake, okay, 50 years ago. So what the real problem here is that they don't get it. So what will they persuade Biden to do? I don't know, but Biden clearly is not really compos mentis fully. And as you know, my notion is that there is a chance that these unpredictable people and unwashed and untrained and unschooled in any military affairs, okay, or whether they might suggest to Biden as a way to save things in Ukraine and, by the way, in the election, would be to drop one of these low yield nuclear weapons, you know, just the mini nukes, you know, somewhere, and just to show the Russians we mean business, you know, just like we showed the Russians we meant business in 1945. Then, of course, we were the only ones that had those kinds of weapons. So that's my fear. Do I really think that these people are capable of doing that? Yes, I do. And that's what stands the hair up in the back of my neck. I mean, they've gone from know this and oh yes this, know this and then this, okay, no 155 millimeter shells left, well, let's do cluster munitions, and oh, there, well, the next one up is a little mini nukes. And there are a lot of people in our Army and Air Force and our Navy that think that mini nukes are possible to use. So I think if Putin looks on the situation the way I just described, he's going to continue to be very discreet, not let him be provoked, let himself to be provoked in any way, and just do attrition in Ukraine, watch what goes on in the Middle East, support Iran to the degree he can, and also count on Chinese support if things really get out of hand. Waiting for the election is the first thing I would suggest is the operative factor here. Caution is another. And you're right. He'll be under more pressure now that the Ukrainians have invaded Russia. But, you know, he's been able to stand up to that pressure before. He's been able to say, look, we can do A, B, and C and not provoke NATO or the U.S. the way they want to be provoked before the election. Okay, let's just play it cool. Do what we have been doing. We're winning after all. We don't have to rise to this bait. That's my clue on that.
And Ray, the other thing would be the way that the Biden administration is talking about this attack. They're saying the way that they didn't know anything about this attack coming. Who's the audience when you look at the U.S. Defense Department spokesman? Patrick Ryder, he was talking about that. We didn't know what, we don't know what's the purpose of this attack. Who's the audience for this type of talks, in your opinion?
Well, spokesman General Ryder is not the sharpest knife in the drawer. I don't know why he said that. It's inconceivable to me that the U.S. didn't know that this was in the works. I mean, if they didn't know, that's a terrible, terrible indictment of U.S. intelligence and operational equities in Ukraine. I mean, they're all over the place there. So I believe they did know. I don't know what game is being played in professing that they didn't know. Perhaps they're afraid that if the Russians do retaliate in a meaningful way, well, they can at least say, well, they didn't, Ukrainians never told us, so go kill Zelensky, not Biden or Harris, you know, that kind of thing. But you know, the whole thing is really unexpected, and it will redound to Russia's advantage once they, well, one commentator said, first they're going to clean the garbage out. And that means clean all the Ukrainians that are left in Kursk, out of Kursk. And in the process, they'll be destroying some of their best armed and best trained troops. What do they have left? Very little. They have no real reserve left to cope with what's going on down south in the Donbas. So, you know, it seems crazy, but again, I would say not to defend Gerasimov, but to say, well, if I were Gerasimov and I saw these people all assembling in a place which, if they went in, they would never get very far and they would get decimated, I would say, well, I don't know, I can't figure this out, but I'm not going to redeploy all my forces to contend with this thing, because we can easily get them once they get into 20 miles inside our border. I may be giving Gerasimov too much credit on that, but the final analysis is that they will be driven back out. And I expect that Zelensky is not very, very long more in power. He's really screwed up things. What has to happen, of course, is all the Americans have to agree, and they'll ask the British as well, when do we dump Zelensky, and who the hell do we have to take his place that we can rely on? Probably that's the operative thing. I don't see anybody that they do have to rely on. So maybe he'll just hang in there till after the election. And then, of course, he'll probably be going to one of his villas abroad that he has invested heavily in.
When it comes to the reasons behind this attack on the Kursk region, there are people who are arguing that maybe what was behind the reason was that Ukraine wanted to be in a better position to negotiate with Russia. And the other reason that people, there are some rumors that says it was because of Shoigu's visit to Iran. They wanted to send a message to Russia. How do you see, in your opinion, because if it was to improve Ukraine's position to negotiate with Russia, it doesn't seem to go that way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people search around for logical explanations for these things. Alexander Kouros and other really smart people have pulled out their hair trying to figure, well, what was the clever thing here? It's really hard sometimes to come to the dumb conclusion that they didn't know what they're doing, and the Russians saw the massing but realized that this would be a really stupid thing to do. And whether they let them do it, apparently, or whether they were totally surprised. In retrospect, that's an interesting question. But now it doesn't matter, because they're going to be thrown out. And the situation would be worse for them, because they were, to a large extent, the reserves that these Ukrainians have. So why did Zelensky do this, with or without U.S. express permission? And I think they had knowledge, at least, if not permission. Well, you know, if it was to capture territory they could later trade for the Donbas or Crimea, well, that's crazy. And you know, to see people like even Putin suggest that, well, they're just kind of grasping for some sort of reasonable explanation. If they thought that they could hold on to that that piece of land, maybe what, 30 square miles or so, they're crazy. And so that's why, if I were a Russian general, I would have been surprised if they try it. The net effect is going to be a major loss to the Ukrainians. And, you know, Donbas is the focus of things. Things are not going well. And again, if it weren't for the election coming up, I think Putin might have to succumb to the pressure to go faster and farther. Now, he did say already that we're going 50% faster there, and we're getting more recruits than ever once our homeland is invaded. So, you know, if you want to do something self-defeating or counterproductive, man, Zelensky has done it in spades.
And Ray, when it comes to the reaction coming from Germany, we saw that the German publication Bild was talking about German tanks on Russian soil again. This is so surprising, because the first question that comes to your mind is how they're thinking of the battlefield right now. Do they really think that Ukraine is winning? That's why they're bragging about these little things that are happening there.
Well, Nima, the media is, I was going to say, almost as bad. It's as bad in Germany as it is in the West, in UK and in the US. So there are many people who believe that Ukraine still has a chance, but that proportion is diminishing. Last poll I saw was that as many as half of the Germans don't want to send any more arms to Ukraine, want the thing to stop, okay? Now, the people who rule Germany are patsies for the U.S. government. I don't know how that came to be, but in various stages after the war, or the Second World War, that was the case. There were people who stood up to the Americans, like Willy Brandt and Egon Bahr and Schröder and others. So, but this crop is very subservient. So I don't know what's going to happen, but I think that the more the Germans realize how much stake they have in this, the more they realize that this is, here's the latest. The Germans have gotten a hold of a Ukrainian who they accuse of blowing up the Nord Stream pipeline. God, you know, hello. Everyone knows who blew up the Nord Stream pipeline, but the Germans just so pretend that this dastardly act that helped to ruin their economy was done by some Ukrainian. You know, that's good indicator of how subservient they are. You know, it's not like there aren't really, really intelligent Germans around. Back in 1933, okay, when Hitler made his big push, made his big push to become dominant in the government and succeeded. In those elections at early 1933, the Nazis were a real minority party. The Social Democrats, the Catholic Centrum Party, they held the balance of power. And they caved. The Catholic Church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church, instead of speaking out when they saw what was happening to the Jews, caved. They could not find their voice. One of the people I have read, who was a young lawyer back in 1933 in Berlin, talked about subservient submissiveness on the part of the Germans. When the Gestapo started to raid their desks and listen to their conversations on the telephone, they would say, well, I don't have any communist connections. It's okay with me. Well, the same thing, of course, happens now in the United States. It's happening to Scott Ritter as we speak. So What's missing is a kern of integrity, of the kind of courage and reasonable anger that is exhibited by people like Scott Ritter to stand up and say, no, this isn't right. And a lot of those people were too afraid to do that. But there were enough of them that knew what was going on. And my point is that kept their mouths shut. Whether they'll do it this time, well, so far, so good. Scholz and all those people, even Merkel, you know, they're all playing the game. And be interesting to see how they react to the presidential election, no matter what happens, whether they'll start to grow up, which has always been my dream for the American, for the German people. One last thing here. When the wall fell in Berlin, and I would point out that 2 days ago, Tuesday, was the anniversary of the building of that Berlin Wall in 1961. I was just getting out of college. I remember, well, I majored in Russian. I said, well, this is going to be, there's going to be some sort of need for what I've learned. So that was the anniversary. Now, when the wall fell, and Poland and Hungary, and finally East Germany decided to get some courage and rose up and threw out the Russians. Well, East Germany, it's good to remember that the East Germans still had 270,000 Soviet troops in East Germany. So what I'm trying to get at here is that this is a big problem. What were they going to do? George H.W. Bush, to his credit, called up Gorbachev and he said, Mikhail, I just want to let you know that I'm not going to dance on the Berlin Wall. Okay, I'm not going to take advantage of your problems and I sympathize with your problems. Okay, so let's get together. How soon can you meet me? Now, that was right after the wall fell on the 9th of November. Okay. Gorbachev says, well, a couple of weeks. Bush says, okay, Malta, first week of December. Okay, Malta, they meet. Jack Matlock, a good friend of mine, the ambassador, was there. Okay, and Bush repeats this promise. He says, look, we want peace. We want a Europe complete and free from Lisbon in Portugal to Vladivostok in the Soviet Far East, okay? So what I want to do is send my Secretary of State, James Baker, to talk with you and Shevardnadze, your foreign minister. How soon can you see him? So first week of December. Gorbachev said, well, give me a couple of weeks, first week of February. Okay, so Baker comes first week of February. And he says, look, he's a smart Texas lawyer, right? So he says, yeah. Now, Mikhail and Edward, I got a deal for you. We would like to have a reunited Germany. Now, when I heard that offer was being made, I have to tell you, Nima, I was alive for the entire World War II, but I was real small, right? But I saw all the movies, I read all the history, and I knew that the very foundation of NATO was to keep Germany divided and down, keep the US in and keep the Russian out, okay? So here's James Baker saying, I want a reunited Germany to Gorbachev and Shevardnadze, who know full well what happened in Kursk in 1943 and Stalingrad, okay? So you can imagine their reaction. They swallowed hard and said, well, this is a pretty painful quid. What's the quo? What are you going to give me for this? And they said, well, Baker said, and this is documented, Jack Matlock, the head of Germany, Kohl at the time, it's all in the memoirs. It says, Baker said, and Kohl said, well, how would it be if we promised not to move NATO 1 inch to the east of of Germany. Well, they thought about it, they bought into it, and they didn't insist on something in writing. Big, big mistake. Now, I have to tell you that Gorbachev, as popular as he was with people like me, who saw what he did in transforming the Soviet Union, the Russian people don't remember much of that. What they remember is they did something very foolish, okay? He didn't get it in writing that there would be no eastward expansion of NATO, and he permitted the reunification of Germany. Now, he was unpopular. I met him. Anyhow, I met him in about 15 years ago in Moscow. It was a great joy. I didn't wash my hand after I shook his hand for about 2 weeks. But he was unpopular in Russia, and the more so now, when they say, well, who let Germany be reunited? Look what they're doing now. They got their tanks going into Kursk, for God's sake. So there's a emotional and a historical reaction among many Russians, all of whom, not all of whom, 90% of them remember their history from their school days. And this is just a long-winded way of saying that the Germans are completely out of it in terms of recognizing that they have a history to live down, that they, with the U.S., tricked the Soviet Union back in 1990, okay? And now they're going to pay the price for that by trying desperately to follow the U.S. lead in a quixotic attempt to move NATO even farther to the east. Pardon the long dialogue here, but, you know, it really distresses me that people don't know their history. And if the Germans don't know that history, well, you know, they should, and they're going to learn that history the hard way.
Yeah. Ray, getting to the conflict in the Middle East right now, we know that it seems that they're trying to have some sort of negotiations between Gazans and Israel. What's going on right now? What's your take on the situation right now in the Middle East?
Well, as far as the hostage negotiations are concerned, Hamas has said they're out of that. You know, if you kill our negotiator, we sort of look askance at that. Hello. So what else is going on? Well, the Western power, the collective West, if you will, are trying desperately to tell Iran, look, we're pledged to defend Israel, so please don't do anything drastic here. It's almost an affront, you know. Here, the Iranians have suffered these assassinations. The Iranians have suffered all means of assassinations, nuclear physicists, everything else, not only the head of Hamas in Tehran on the inauguration day of the new president. So here's the West telling, look, please don't go too far here when you react. Please restrain yourself because we back Israel 100%. Well, I don't think that's going to do anything in terms of restraining Iran. I think they'll be careful. I think they have the Russians advising them that the gradualist approach is probably the best, as indicated by what's happening in Ukraine now. And I would think that they would be advising them, and the Chinese as well, to limit themselves to military targets. Targets that will really hurt the Israelis, but stay away from civilians. I think actually Putin has already said that publicly. So what the Iranians decide to do is going to be interesting. I don't think it'll be long in coming now, probably in next week. The big question, of course, is will they take shots or will they fire missiles at sitting ducks? And what I call sitting ducks are the 900 troops the U.S. has in northern Syria, uninvited, by the way. Well, why are they there? President Trump explained, well, to steal the oil. And that's what they're doing. They're also very fertile agricultural fields up there. 900 troops, sitting ducks. Iraq. Well, I think it's 1,500 U.S. troops there, sitting ducks. Are they? Have they been invited by Iraq? Well, back 5, 6, 7, 10 years ago, yeah. But they've been since invited, disinvited or invited to leave by the Iraqi parliament. Why don't they leave? Oh, they're still fighting ISIS. And then, oh, come on, give me a break. So these are sitting ducks, plus the fact that there are all kinds of bases around that area that the U.S. occupies. There are all kinds of ways where the Iranians could hit U.S. targets. And of course, they're accusing the U.S. of being directly involved in the assassination of the Hamas leader in Tehran. So that would be something new, but not unexpected. I would expect that that's more likely than not. And then how will the U.S. react? Well, depends on what you mean by the U.S. There are people who want war. I will say that again. There are people who want war, a larger war. And these are people with influence in the White House. And they're more relatively moderate voices that say, well, wait a second now. We want to get involved in the Middle East and in, my God, in Ukraine. And like, what would the Chinese do? That's the other thing. The Chinese are actively involved now in diplomacy. They've brought 14, count them, 14 Palestinian factions together, including Hamas and the well, better known ones, in Beijing. And they signed a joint statement saying, okay, we're going to cooperate. We're going to really cooperate this time. And we're going to see that Palestine's interests are met. Okay. Well, that's the first time that happened. Now, how did the Chinese do these things? I don't know, but the Chinese actually created a more decent relationship between Saudi Arabia and Iran as well. Everybody's surprised about that. And then the Russians, well, they have a military airlift going into Ukraine, probably some very, very sophisticated electronic warfare systems. One is called Murmansk. Don't ask me to explain it, but it's very effective, apparently. And then they had a whole bunch of IL-76s, IL-96s, big, big, wide-body transport, not transport, but freight aircraft, bringing in what people think might be S-400 anti-aircraft missiles. Now, this could be a formidable air defense of some of the Iranian nuclear facilities. One last thing to mention here is that Ukraine does not have a nuclear weapon. You may be told that, well, Tony Blinken said 2 weeks ago that they were 2 weeks or 1 or 2 weeks away from having a nuclear. Well, what he said was 2 weeks away from having
Iran.
Enough.
Right.
Yeah. Iran, right.
Iran doesn't have nuclear.
Yeah, Iran doesn't. Sorry. Iran. So, what's the deal here? The deal is that, Iran does not have a nuclear weapon, but it has enough in highly enriched uranium to fuel one. There have been high-level Iranian announcements that maybe they'll revisit this decision made by the Ayatollahs that that nuclear weapons are against Islam. Maybe look at that again, given what's happened. But those are just generals talking. The U.S. intelligence community has, to its credit, since November 2007, repeated every year that there is no evidence that Iran is working on a nuclear weapon. Okay, enriched uranium, of course, they need that for other purposes. And highly enriched uranium, they got that too. But a weapon, they haven't weaponized it. Now, they may do so. But the point is that they haven't done so yet. At least that's what the intelligence community said as recently as March of this year. I don't see them changing that. So if you hear people, particularly Israelis, saying that, they've got a nuclear weapon now, that's going to be very, very dangerous. Why do I say that? Because my main fear is that that the Israelis will use a nuclear weapon in extremis, okay? How are they likely to get in extremis if they attack Hezbollah, if they attack Iran, if they widen the war, and if the U.S., miracle of miracles, decides not to come in with both feet, okay? Now, I think Netanyahu is counting on the U.S. being unable to avoid coming in. They'll have to come in, especially in a political and election year, for obvious reasons. But let's say the U.S. doesn't come in. Let's say that the fate of Israel is in the balance. Would they resort to employing one of these smaller nuclear weapons? Well, prominent Israeli military specialists have said in the past, look, rather than face defeat for the Jewish state, we have the means to bring the whole world down, and we will. One of those people is a fellow named Van Krefeld. He's actually born in Rotterdam, but he went to Israel when he was 2 years old, and he became one of their most distinguished, if that's the word, military historian. His books are on the bookshelf of prominent U.S. military academies. U.S. colonels are forced to read Van Krefeld, as well as Sun Tzu and von Clausewitz and the rest of them. So this is a serious guy. And this is what he said, not too long, well, it was it was 20 years ago, but I asked some of my professional friends who are military colonels who are in touch with their counterparts in Israel. And I said, check this out with them. Is this still pretty much the doctrine? And the answer came back, sorry, Ray, yes, that's still the feeling. That rather than see the whole enterprise go under, the whole Zionist enterprise, they would, like Samson, pull down the pillars, killing not only themselves, but everybody in the region. Do I think that's likely to happen? In extremis, I think the chances are better than even. That's why I hope that some reasonable people are able to make a dent on Blinken and Sullivan and say, look, you know, you better tell Netanyahu that if he takes on Hezbollah, if he tries to widen this war to mousetrap us in, we're not going to play the game anymore, okay? Don't even try it. The chances of that happening, well, maybe 50-50. The chances of Netanyahu taking it seriously in an election year, less than 10%. So I fear for what's in store there.
Ray, just to wrap up this session, I want to talk about your latest article in the Consortium News, in which you said journalism is not like war. In war, the victors get to write the history. In today's journalism, the losers write it. Could you elaborate on this article?
Yeah. Well, you know, it has to do with Russiagate. It has to do with weapons of mass destruction that weren't there. Ties between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda that weren't there. And Russiagate. Sorry, folks, to tell you this, Russiagate wasn't there either. Okay. Now, where do I start? Well, let me start with this article. It was prompted by a new article in Rolling Stone by Michael Van Landingham. Who's he? Well, he's a CIA analyst who is bragging about his being the principal drafter, wrote the first draft of the so-called intelligence community assessment of January 6, 2017, saying, in effect, the Russians helped Trump win the election. This is, mind you, a couple of weeks before Trump was even inaugurated, to help the Russians. The Russians helped Trump win the election, and they did that by hacking emails from the Democratic National Committee, okay? Emails that looked really bad for Hillary Clinton, because in effect they said that they showed Hillary stole the nomination from Bernie Sanders. The DNC and Hillary cooperated quite well in making sure that Bernie didn't have a chance, okay? So somebody got those emails and gave them to WikiLeaks, and WikiLeaks published them 3 days before the Democratic National Convention, okay? Now, WikiLeaks acknowledged that they had emails relating to Hillary Clinton in June 12th, 2016, and that they were going to publish them. So the Democrats had, what, a good month and a half to figure out how they would reply. Hillary got together with her counselors, the primary of whom was a fellow named Jacob Sullivan, real smart guy, you know, brainchild. And he said, I know what we'll do. We'll blame the Russians for hacking into the DNC and giving them to WikiLeaks. We'll blame the Russians because we hate the Russians. We hate the DNC. And that way we could say, look, the Russians were responsible for trying to help Trump. You know, this is before Trump won. Okay. So that's what they did. And that's what Russiagate relied on, these hacked, so-called hacked emails. Well, long story short, we found out that no one hacked the DNC. We could find that out right off the bat. I say veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, because we had two former technical directors of the National Security Agency, NSA, in our collective. And we wrote this memo on 12 December 2016, okay, telling people, look, the technical evidence shows that no one hacked into the DNC, that it was a copy onto a thumb drive or some other external storage device. It wasn't a hack. We would know if it was a hack, and they drew on documents released by Ed Snowden, by their own technical expertise. After all, they built these systems to collect these things, these two technical directors and another very senior official from NSA. So we published that on December 12th, 2016. We're proud of that because it turned out to be right. What happened next? Well, a year later, finally, the Democrats who were heading the House Intelligence Committee were able to get the head of CrowdStrike to testify about the Russian hack. Now, you have to remember that James Comey, head of the FBI at the time, said, well, you know, we don't want to do the forensics on the Democratic National Committee computers, or, well, let's hire CrowdStrike. CrowdStrike, run by somebody who worked for the head of FBI for 20 years as his big techie, okay? CrowdStrike. Sean Henry is the guy's name, okay? Let's get CrowdStrike to do this. Well, what happens? CrowdStrike testifies before the House Intelligence Committee on the 5th of December, 2017, and says, there is no evidence that anyone hacked into the DNC emails, those particular ones, not the Russians, not anyone else, no technical evidence at all. Now we have, sometimes this bears resemblance to what the Russians do sometimes, but that's with circumstantial evidence. Now, that's pretty conclusive. No Russian hack, no hack by anybody else. Obviously, a copy onto a thumb drive or some other external storage device. So what do we have here? Well, that's testimony that one would have thought the president of the United States, Trump, would have released right away. But guess what? Adam Schiff, who took over the House Intelligence Committee, put it in his bottom drawer of his safe and kept it concealed until somebody told Trump 2.5 years later, hey, you're the president, Mr. Trump. All you have to do is tell me, the new director of national intelligence, and I'll just tell Adam Schiff to release that, or I'm going to release it. And so he did. And Adam Schiff released it. The date was May 7, 2020. Today is August 15, 2024. Okay. Do the math. Do the math. The Americans still don't know that nobody hacked into those DNC emails, that it was all a big story. Getting back to this Rolling Stone story, this fellow on Landingham is proud of having written the first draft, and he's resurrected the whole thing gratuitously. You would have thought he'd be ashamed, but you know what? He's not ashamed, because people are playing this. They don't play what veteran intelligence professionals for Sanity said, not only now, but as early as December 2016, right? 2016, it was not a hack. So what we have here is a resurgence of this myth that the Russians were responsible for Donald Trump, for God's sake. They really hurt Hillary. And by the way, the Russians are really black. Putin is just like Hitler. And you know, this is not academic. It's not academic, Mima. I mean, for God's sake, If the White House tells the American people these guys are really demonic, and we have to send our troops to help this poor Zelensky turn the tide in Ukraine, I would dare say the majority of Americans would say, "Oh my God, if they're that bad, sure we have to do that." If they're responsible for Donald Trump, there's a Trump derangement syndrome here. I won't spell it out any further, but I don't know what I mean. And people are willing to believe anything about anybody who is accused of having helped Donald Trump. So we tried to expose this, and it was sort of like a hard thing to do again, because we had done so much of this since 2016. But we thought that, well, since they're trying to raise this thing again, we have to put this to rest. And I forget what the metaphor you use, but I look at it as kind of a science fiction ironclad monster that's impervious to whatever bullets or rockets or missiles it won't die. Maybe it's like a vampire, and we haven't found the right stake to put into its heart. But, you know, it's not academic. It's noxious. And it's really, really, really important that people realize that all this stuff, this Russiagate stuff, was made up out of whole cloth by the likes of James Comey, head of the FBI, John Brennan, head of the CIA, a bunch of bureaucrats heading NSA, and the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, who famously told a leading interviewer, you know, the Russians, you know, they're genetically prone to be deceitful and to do blah 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 blah. They're almost genetically prone to do that. Now, this is the head of national intelligence. This is the guy who picked people like Michael Van Landingham to draft this spurious memo, blaming the hacking and everything else on the Russians, and no one has been held to account. And that's the point. See, the people who publish this stuff in Rolling Stone, and people like David Korn and Michael Isikoff, who wrote the Russian roulette thing, giving credence to this bizarre story about Trump cavorting with prostitutes in Moscow. I mean, hello, all these people were sucked into this thing and profited handsomely from it. And when you talk about paying a price, not only has no one paid a price, and they're still repeating this stuff, but when push came to shove, there was a fellow, I'll finish with this, He was a head of the op-ed section of the Washington Post. His name was Fred Hyatt, right? Now, he was publishing things in 2002, early 2003, before the invasion of Iraq, saying it was sure that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, okay? No matter what Scott Ritter told him, Scott having verified the destruction of all these things, okay? They have them and they're going to use them. And the first thing we might have is a mushroom cloud, like Condoleezza Rice says, and all this business. And besides, they have ties with Al Qaeda. Inference there, of course. Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. I mean, hell, this is the whole picture. People forget. That's the way it was back then. Now, Fred Hyatt went up after it was discovered that there were no ties between Iraq and Al-Qaeda, despite Colin Powell telling the Security Council on the 5th of February, 2003, that there was a sinister nexus between Iraq and Al-Qaeda, that there were no weapons of mass destruction. Fred Hyatt was interviewed by the Columbia Review of Journalism. Big deal in journalism, okay? And one of the young fellows there says, now, Mr. Hyatt, you kept repeating for months and months as flat fact that that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Oh, how do you explain that? And Hyatt said, oh, well, if weapons of mass destruction weren't there, we probably should not have said that they were. Now, when I heard that, Bob Parry, the wonderful journalist par excellence, was next to me, and he said, well, yeah, Ray, that seems to be a principal precept of journalism, right? If something's not so, you're not supposed to say it is, right? One more thing I can't resist. James Clapper, the head of national intelligence, wrote his memoir. And at the end of 2019, I think it was, or might have been 18, he was peddling his memoir at the Carnegie Institute there in Washington. And I used to go to those things and I learned about it. And so I went, as is my custom, I went a half hour early. I bought the book, $27 it was, you know, but it was worth it because I went into the men's room and I went to the index, I found out what he said about weapons of mass destruction. Now, for background here, Clapper was head of the Imagery Analysis Group, a separate agency that was charged with analyzing all the imagery, whether it's photographic, radar, infrared, multispectral. It's his job to look at all this imagery and decide what's there, okay? And so he was in charge of finding weapons of mass destruction in Iraq before the war. So how's he explain this? Oh, it's amazing. I mean, the guy is not the sharpest knife in the drawer. I think I said that before. Anyway, he says, well, you know, this is in the book. Okay? Dick Cheney was putting great pressure on us to find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And so we found 150 or so suspect sites, but we never could find any weapons of mass destruction. And so in the end, and I was as guilty of this as all the other intelligence people, in the end, we were under such pressure that we found things that weren't really there, period, end quote. So, you know, so at the Q&A, I was not recognized for who I was. They recognized me. And I said, Mr. Clapper, so you were under such pressure and before Iraq to find things that weren't really there, and you found things that weren't really there. Now, did you do a repeat performance on Russiagate? Now, you said that the Russians hacked into the DNC emails, but we know now from court testimony that's not so. You worked for a new president, but under great pressure from, did you find things that weren't really there again? And he said, no. I talked with NSA, and I said, yeah, we have two former technical directors of NSA. They wrote the paper, and they've been proven right. So the head of the Carnegie Institute was a fellow named William Burns at the time. He's now head of the CIA. And finally, to his credit, he let me challenge him. We had 5 minutes of discussion, so to speak. And finally, so okay, now, Mr. McGovern, lay this microphone. So they gave it to a pink, code pink person behind me, and she starts saying, Mr. Clapper, when you lied to the Senate Intelligence Committee about electronic eavesdropping, how is it you were permitted to keep your job? So I could see Clapper saying, whoa, maybe I should vet my audience a little better. Anyhow, Clapper, I was in charge of all this stuff. And, you know, when you look at who has most to lose, and, you know, I don't want to disturb everybody, but if I were to look at who has motive to prevent Donald Trump from becoming president again, Donald Trump this time being not totally naive to the ways of Washington, Donald Trump this time knowing exactly what was done to him and by whom, you know, there were no better candidates than Clapper, James Comey, FBI director, John Brennan, CIA director, people who have a lot to lose if their crimes, and I use that word advisedly, crimes, are revealed. How do you explain James Comey, big lawyer, playing fast and loose with the law and regulation, everything else before the election? Well, he explains it in his book. He says, quote, I was operating in an environment in which Hillary Rodham Clinton was sure to be the next president of the United States, period, end quote. Well, if you're operating in that kind of environment, I mean, you take all kinds of liberties with the law if you have no conscience, or if you're a lousy lawyer like James Comey, and you get worried about being indicted, you're going to be promoted, you'll be head of the Department of Justice before you know it. You're not going to be indicted. Certainly Trump's not going to win, which he did, right? And certainly Trump's not going to win again, which he might. So what am I saying here? I'm saying that there are all kinds of, well, there were too many coincidences in this attempted assassination of Donald Trump. And like an old detective, you know, analysts are very much like this. They look for motive, means, and opportunity. Now, the means, you could get a gun, you could get a rifle like that anywhere, you know. I don't think personally, the Second Amendment entitles you to do that, but there it is, the law. Opportunity, right before the Republican National Convention, a couple of days, where he becomes the candidate. Now, motive. Who has the most to lose if Trump comes back in as president? Now, all this is circumstantial, but you know, that's about all we have to go on. Just too many mistakes put together. Last word on this. I asked Bill Binney, who's a mathematician, pure and so he did excellent mathematician. Everybody respects him. I said, now, Bill, you mathematicians know about probabilities, right? Yeah, sure. Okay, well, now, each of these five occurrences here on that day when the attempted assassination took place, each of these has, I think you'll agree, maybe a 10% chance of being an accident, or 10% chance of happening, okay? So you take five of those, or 10 of those, and you put them all together and you multiply them, and in aggregate, what are the chances of a random thing like this happening and You could do the math yourself. He said about one in 100,000, okay? So probabilities are another thing. What am I saying? I'm saying, well, I'll leave you with this on this one. I don't know who Trump has now doing his personal security. I would suggest he hire Bobby Kennedy's firm rather than the Secret Service. Because from what I've observed, I think that they're going to try again, okay? It's just too much of a danger. And when I say they, I mean the deep state. I mean some of the miscreants that I've already mentioned here. They need to be exposed. And people like Fred Hyatt, rest his soul, he's since died, are not going to expose it. So it's up to us to do that without fear or favor. And if you see the FBI coming at my door, Nima, I hope that you'll intervene and tell them I'm basically a good guy.
Thank you so much, Ray, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
You're most welcome, Nima.